One, two, three, four.
Welcome to episode 2 of the At a Crossroads.net Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to look behind the curtain of what it is like to be in ministry leadership. This is both to benefit those in ministry leadership, trying to find ways to handle the sinful tendencies that come along with ministry leadership, try to find healing from these different areas that we might struggle with. It's also to benefit our listeners who go to church, who read books by Christian authors, and who want to try to figure out the best ways to support their ministry leaders, what are healthy, Christ-centered ways of looking at ministry leaders, and what are some ways that we can turn ministry leadership into idolatry and how to avoid that sort of thing. So if you missed episode 1, I encourage you to check it out. Interviewed Ken Weitzma. He's the author of, recently, The Grand Paradox that just came out, as well as the book Pursuing Justice. And he's the founder of the Justice Conference coming up in June. We had a great conversation about spiritual fatigue, about what it's like to be a pastor, and just the paradox that it is to be humble in Jesus, but also to be seen by many as this sort of non-human, perfect spiritual person. So check that out. In today's episode, we will be interviewing Ted Kluck. Ted is the author of 15 books. His most recent book came out on March 1st called The Dropbox. And we'll be talking quite a bit about his second most recent book, Household Gods, which came out in the fall of 2014. Ted is also an adjunct professor at Cornerstone University, teaches communications and culture there, as well as a class, mass media and culture. He does 2 podcasts. One is called the Gut Check Podcast, which goes along with the Gut Check Empire that he and friend Zach Bartels started. It's a publishing company, as well as Ted is also on the Happy Rant podcast. So, without further ado, we will bring Ted in on the phone.
Well, hey, Ted, thanks so much for being on the second episode of Behind the Curtain. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Well, hey, I got to be honest. So this morning, I'm doing a little bit of homework, so to speak, on interviewing you, and I listened to the Happy Rant podcast.
Okay.
Right? And you do. And who are the guys you do that with?
The two guys are Stephen Altrogi, who's kind of a blogger, podcaster. He does some church stuff down in Tallahassee, Florida. And the other guy is Barnabas Piper, who's a great author in his own right, but is probably best known at this point for being Barnabas Piper's son. Or, I'm sorry, being John Piper's son.
I got you. So. So I was listening to it, and I listened to a couple episodes ago where you guys were talking about, is it wrong to buy yourself onto the New York Times, you know, bestseller list?
Right.
And so I got to be honest, and this has nothing to do with what you guys talked about. It was great. But I started, like, Googling things after that, and I felt, like, nauseous. I felt, like, sick to my stomach as a Christian and as this young pastor, you know, myself, who wants to be an author and these sorts of things. And so what I want to do to start with, so you've written 15 books. That's a lot. And some of your books are sports-related, but a lot of them are Christian, you know, books, Christian nonfiction, writing through Christian publishers. Most people have no idea how Christian publishing actually works. And so, kind of to start, can you just describe, even in just an objective, like, way, how does the Christian publishing industry work? And then we'll kind of springboard from there.
Yeah, great question, man. And really, the answer to that is going to vary depending on who you are, what kind of work you do, writing-wise, but then also what kind of work you do sort of in the daytime, as it were. And I think, you know, Christian writing works a lot differently for me than it works for most people. So I'll explain how it works for most people in Christian writing. For most people, you're the pastor of a church, or you're the head of a denomination, or you're the head of a big kind of parachurch, nonprofit type of thing, where in each of those scenarios, you have a ton of constituents, right? So you have a ton of people who are already primed to buy your book because they're a member of your 5,000-seat church, or, you know, they know you as the president of Focus on the Family or whatever. So, so typically, Christian publishing works with you being in one of those scenarios and then going to a publisher and saying, I have an idea for a book. The publisher looks it over. They say, great, you've already got, you know, 10,000 people who are ready to buy it, and then you get a deal based on that. For me, because, you know, none of those things apply to me, you know, I'm just a writer. I'm not a pastor. I'm not the head of a huge organization, unless you count Gut Check, of course, which I don't know that we're counting in this case. But for me, it's been more about the writing and less about the platform, in the sense that I'll have an idea for a book. My agent, Andrew Walgamuth, and I will work it out. He's an amazing guy, great agent, who's been working with me now for almost a decade. And he'll help me develop the idea. We'll put together a proposal, and we'll send it around to various publishers in the industry who we think it would be a good fit for. And for me, you know, from a writing standpoint, these books have always been about, I think, telling a great story first, having the writing be really unique and fresh, and then obviously in the Christian market, having it be something that's true to Scripture biblically, and something that's an encouragement for people, and that will either challenge people to think deeper or will kind of come alongside them and encourage them in their faith. And that's been my goal. And honestly, there's been a lot of ups and downs, you know, I mean, there's been as much or more failure in all that than there has been success. But, you know, but looking back on it, I can see it really has been the Lord that's allowed me to keep doing this, you know, even though I thought at times that I had some talent, and I think that I have some talent, and I can tell a good story. You know, it really has been the Lord allowing me time and time again to keep getting these opportunities.
So in my brief experience of trying to get published, I the thing I've been most surprised by is it seems like, and I guess I don't, the statement I'll say, it seems like publishers don't care about content. I mean, and I know there's limits to that. Obviously, there's some restraint about content, but it seems like they don't care about content. They only care about, will this book sell? And I'm not trying to demonize the publishers, like,
look, exactly.
Businesses, right? But I guess for the average Christian who's just like picking up books on the shelf, I mean, you mentioned it briefly, like, if you're the pastor of a 5,000 person church, you'll pretty much be able to get published because they're going to, you know, you'll be able to. So where do problems come in with that? I mean, I just think, like, there's something that's, I want to believe that the stuff we're reading is, like, worth it was worth being written. And it doesn't seem like that's the case sometimes.
Yeah. No, great stuff, man, and great issues. And I think a lot of what you're saying there is true. You know, for me, I think one reason that I can point to just kind of right off the bat for that is there's been so much kind of cross-media convergence over the last decade where a lot of your kind of old standard Christian publishers, if you will, like the Zondervans of the world, are now just kind of in the downstream of these big, you know, secular media conglomerates, such that you know, the publisher that you may have trusted 10 or 15 years ago to put out a good book with solid theology is now, you know, really and truly just driven by profit, because, you know, the people making the decisions at the top don't, you know, maybe don't have the care and the concern for Scripture and the gospel that they used to. So I think that's one thing. I think another thing that kind of works against great content in Christian writing is just the amount of turnover in the industry that you have from year to year. I mean, the editors that I'm working with now won't be the editors who will be at that company next year. I mean, there's so much job hopping and turnover, and, you know, I've had editors leave in the middle of projects. I've had, you know, I've worked with editors who are now on their second or third publishing company since I got into the business 10 years ago. So, you know, I mean, there's so little continuity that I think my perspective as kind of a writer's writer is to look for writer's editors. to look for editors who, you know, they all say they care about writing, but at the end of the day, you know, there are a handful who really like good writing and who really read good writing and who care about good writing. And I guess, you know, again, it's helpful to have an agent to kind of identify who those people are. But, you know, for me, it's going to be more worth it to me in the long run to work with people like that who really do care about the craft and who care about writing.
So for this section of the interview, we won't mention any names. So without mentioning any names, what are some of what I would consider like shady ways that books are written? So for example, most people assume the name on the cover, that person, whoever it is, a pastor, they sit down with their laptop, right, and they type up a book and then it gets published. So that doesn't always happen, though. What are some other ways that things get published?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's degrees of shadiness, you know, and I've heard of, you know, I've heard of pastors having assistants write all their books. I've heard of, you know, pastors just kind of cobbling together old sermon notes, and I don't think that's shady. I think it's a less interesting way to write a book, but I don't think it's shady. You know, I think where shadiness comes in, Noah, and this speaks to just sin nature in the human heart. I mean, I think shadiness comes in where a pastor or an author is more concerned about his or her image and perception in the public than they are about, you know, just writing a really honest book. And I think, you know, most of the ghostwriting that I've done, with the exception of one project that went really bad, most of them that I've done, my name's been on the cover. So it's been really transparent and honest where I've written a book for somebody, whether it's been an athlete or a celebrity or a pastor or a missionary or whatever, and it's had my name on the book, you know. Some people know that, you know, it's this person's ideas, it's this person's vision for the book, but Ted Kluck helps them get there. And and I think, you know, that's the scenario that I'm most comfortable with. And I think almost everybody that I've worked with in that context has been committed to doing a good book and taking the time that's been needed to do a good book. And, you know, it hasn't been just, hey, my name's hot, let's slap a name on there and get it out, you know. And, and you know, the one or two that I took or that I explored that was the case for, those are the ones that went really badly. So, I mean, those are learning experiences for me where I go, man, when I have that little niggling, you know, voice of doubt on my shoulder, or the catch in the spirit, or whatever you want to call it, like, I really need to listen to that, because when I haven't listened to it, that's when I've, you know, I've really had a horrible experience and gotten, you know, gotten raked over the coals, or gotten bitter, or gotten, you know, whatever. So you got to learn from those things if you're going to be on your own in this business.
So we all put these like subtitles under our names, you know, on Twitter or whatever it might be. So I'm a pastor, you know, a blogger, and then I want to put that title author under there, right? So let me ask you this. If there's I agree, it's not shady. Like, it's not sinful for a pastor to take some sermons they've done and have an assistant basically package those sermons into a book form. So a side thought I had is, one thing is, they just need to be honest about that. Like you said, with the ghostwriting, what I think is shady and even to the point of sinful is when they don't acknowledge that that's what they're doing and they act like, you know, anyway. But my question is, let's say a pastor does that and they've never written a book before, but they're making it big. They're sort of a hot name. So some of their sermons get compiled into a manuscript and then gets published as a book. Would you consider them to be an author still?
Wow, that's a I know I say this after every question, but that's another really great question. And I would say no, Noah, simply because I have such respect for writers and for authors. And I have huge respect for what it takes to make a book and what it takes to make a book great. And, you know, the kind of care and the kind of time that goes into making a really good book. And, you know, if anything, I'm a little ashamed at how prolific I've had to be over the last decade just to like keep food on the table, because, you know, I think if it were up to me, I would have worked slower. I would have lingered over the projects a little bit more, and I would have tried to make them more great. And, you know, for somebody who just, sort of has an assistant, you know, slap some things together and call it and call it a book and put it out there. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that that person's an author, really. I think they're a personality. I think they could even be a great pastor.
Sure.
But I think to call yourself an author, some real care for the craft needs to be taking place, and some real writing needs to be taking place. And I just worked with a guy, actually. The book is coming out in a few months. I don't know when exactly it's coming out. But this guy's a pastor in Los Angeles. He's got a big church. And he had really, really good things to say. And he needed help with the writing, and he knew he needed help. And he reached out to me to work with him on the manuscript and to give him help. But it was such a great experience because, you know, even though he maybe didn't have the natural, you know, gifting right away or affinity for the writing, I mean, he really poured himself into the process and rewrites and editing. And at the end of the day, he really made a great book that he can put his name on and be proud of and truly call himself an author, you know, because he put the work in and he did a great book. And I think it's possible. I think it's possible even for people who don't consider themselves great writers or don't go into it with a bunch of natural talent for writing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think some craft-mindedness has to be there.
Yeah. Oh, that is a great example. That's a great example you gave, that guy in L.A. I guess I don't want to make this huge point of it, but it just seems like authors, they should write. And I mean, the definition of an author is, like, you write, you know. And so if you just, like, even if you just, like, dictate your story to someone and they write, I'm not even sure you're an author. You've just dictated your story anyway. Just, I don't know.
Right.
And the reason I bring it up is it brings me to, yeah, and you mentioned it already, this there's this facade that you know, pastors, a lot of, you know, it's Christian authors, but pastors sometimes will put on, and being an author can kind of become a part of that facade. And so I want to get back to what I led with this idea of buying yourself onto the New York Times bestseller list. And we're not going to talk about that in detail like you guys did. Unhappy Rant, I think I'd refer people to that. It was a really good conversation. But my thing is, well, maybe first explain how that happens. You know, there's just that idea of, like, well, how do you buy yourself on the New York Times list? But then the question I want to ask you is, why are we, and I'll say we as in pastors, why are we obsessed with being celebrities?
Yeah.
So tell us how to buy yourself out of the New York Times. If anybody wants to do it, Ted Kluck will tell you. Ted Kluck will tell you how.
Wow, there it is. Well, and let's be clear. Yeah. Ted Kluck has never been able to get himself onto the New York Times bestseller list.
You haven't bought it, man. Come on, you got.
I haven't bought it. Well,
you can work on this, Ted. I know people. I know a firm. I know a marketing firm that I can connect you with, brother.
Man. I don't like where this is going, but I'll give kind of a theological answer and then I'll give a practical answer. But the theological answer is it's a part of our sinful human hearts to want the praise of man.
Okay.
And
yeah.
I think nobody's really different than anybody else in that, you know. So I far be it for me to cast the first stone at, you know, at Mark Driscoll or whoever for wanting to have an successful book and wanting a lot of people to read it and wanting to be even at some level famous for it. You know, I think for the pastor, especially right now, and this is the part, dude, that pains me a little bit. You know, I think especially for young pastors, you know, they'll come to me sometimes and they'll be like, dude, I don't have a book deal yet. Like, what am I doing wrong?
Mm.
And it's just like, you're not doing anything wrong. You know, like you're pastoring, you're serving your local church body. Like there's, it's only within the last decade and the blogosphere and social media and all this stuff where young pastors feel like, man, I'm nothing if I'm not a quote unquote pastor scholar, you know, I'm nothing if I don't have a book deal. And it's like, you know, that's such falsehood, you know, and it's ego. It's the industry. I think social media plays a huge role in it because, you know, I'm not on Twitter or Facebook anymore, thankfully.
Sure.
But when I was, I mean, it was, you know, every day it was another pastor sort of, you know, posting the picture of the open box of books that he just got from his publisher. And, you know, Which on one level is cool, but on another very real level, it just kind of serves to make everyone else feel like crap.
Sure.
And it creates all this pressure that shouldn't be there for pastors. So I think that's one huge part of it. And as far as how you get from that impulse to like buying your way onto the New York Times bestseller list, I can say from some experience that, you know, you get into these marketing meetings with a publisher and ideas are flying around. You're not terribly engaged with it anyway because you're a writer and not a marketer. And people are making decisions about your book and about the launch of your book. And I can see how in not too many steps you could end up being the guy like buying your way onto the bestseller list because
right.
some marketing company who you really don't know and who you really haven't had any familiarity with goes, well, see, we get all these unique credit card numbers and we buy the books and then we give the books to your ministry. But as far as like, you know, the actual sales numbers, that'll go toward your bestseller list. And I can see how in those meetings, if it's presented the right way, it wouldn't really sound that shady and you would end up agreeing to it.
Sure.
And, so again, man, I mean, so many people have vilified Drisky for so many things over the last several months. Like I have some sympathy for the guy where I go, mm-hmm. you know, when you get that big and you're at that level, you know, stuff is happening that, you know, may or may not be entirely under your control and you may or may not entirely know how it's working. And I can see how it would happen. That being said, I think the whole practice is shady and
yeah.
I think it's a really bad idea. And I think again, I mean, back to my first point, it just speaks to, it speaks to the level of ego and the need for affirmation of everybody involved. And I think honestly too, Noah, on another theological point, I mean, just kind of a lack of fundamental faith in God's sovereign ability
yes.
to do with the book whatever he will do with it. So
right.
when I write a book, I try to say, you know, I'll do my level best to market it to the degree that I feel comfortable with. But beyond that, it's really up to the Lord. You know, it's up to the Lord how many people read this book and which people read this book and how those people are impacted or not impacted by the book.
Yeah, In some ways, it's practical to me in my life as I try to seek wisdom kind of before I get swallowed up by this machine and can, you know, because it's on one hand, and you hear people say, well, you know, it's for the gospel, like your book, it's about Jesus. It's
yeah.
for the gospel.
Yeah.
So like you should do anything
yeah.
right to get it out there. And what,
yeah.
what you really end up doing, though, so you think in your mind, you're like, yeah, and probably in your conscious mind, you're thinking, yeah, I'm marketing Jesus. I'm marketing the gospel. But what really happened,
yeah.
and dude, the same thing happened to me with my church plant. So I started mm-hmm. my church and I'm like, I want to see thousands of people come to know Jesus, right? Because who doesn't
right.
want that for the kingdom? But
exactly.
what you're actually doing is you're saying, I want thousands of people to come to know Jesus. So I feel really validated as a church
yeah.
planter. And so people
yep.
think I'm really cool and smart. And so
yep.
in your book, it's the same. You're like, you're telling yourself, I'm marketing this for Jesus, but you're really marketing yourself. And the worst thing about it is you read a book about like how to expand your platform or whatever. And I don't know, there's like business models that are applied, like marketing. Here's how to market a product. But then
yeah.
I don't think
yeah.
the gospel is not a product. And so I just wrestle with it, right? So Jesus tells us
yeah.
like the first will be last and the last will be first. And your left hand isn't to know what your right hand's doing. And Jesus
right.
is the
right.
celebrity, not us. And then you're like, oh, you want to publish a book? Okay, well, make yourself a celebrity. Tell everybody
yep.
how cool you are, and then you'll be successful. But it's about the gospel, so it's okay. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, dude, a great many shady things have been done by a great many people under the guise of God told me to do this, or I'm just doing it for the gospel. I mean,
yeah,
I don't
okay.
think – I mean, with all due respect – to people who talk like that, I don't think we can trust that as a defense for most things, you know.
Yeah.
And I think what you said is absolutely right. You know, what we're doing, it has to square with, you know, kind of how God calls us to conduct ourselves in Scripture. And you know, I can't really see a scenario in Scripture where, you know, it's okay to self-promote all the time. You know,
mm-hmm.
in addition to just being annoying and really off-putting and like,
yeah.
gross.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that's okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I've kind of taken this approach, and it probably, you know, makes people angry in publishing who I work with, but I've taken a very kind of low marketing approach to my stuff and just kind of gone, you know what, Lord, do with it what you will. And, we'll see how the chips fall, but it's a level of marketing that I feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think for every author and for everybody who's, you know, a personality at one level or another, you have to do what you're comfortable with. And I think, you know, podcasting is a great example of something that I never would have thought I would have enjoyed, and I never would have thought I would have done it. But it seems a little bit more fun and more honest and less just kind of shameless and self-promoting than like tweeting about yourself 50 times a day or whatever. You know, to me it feels more okay. I don't know if it is at the end of the day, but you know, it feels more okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about your journey with that. So you mentioned you used to be on Twitter, you used to be on Facebook, you used to have kind of the bright, shiny website. And something I really appreciated about your book, Finding God in the Dark, which is just super transparent, super honest. I love it. You talk about killing Big T in there. Mm-hmm. And so I want to just tell us, like, who Big T is or was and how you killed Big T. But first I want to read a quote that you you quoted Madonna, who's a great theologian, in there.
Of course.
And but man, I relate to this so much. She says, I have an iron will, and all of my will has always been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. My drive in life is from this horrible feeling of being mediocre. So talk about this and Big T.
Yeah, I think that's definitely where I was. And I don't know if that's a function of, you know, growing up in a small town in the middle of nowhere in Indiana and just feeling like I had to do something to distinguish myself. I don't know what it was, you know, but I always had very much that fear of being ordinary or flying under the radar or not doing anything significant. And, you know, I know that's something you can relate to. And I think a lot of people can relate to it at one level or another, but you know, Big T was, and to be clear, I was never on Twitter, but I was all over Facebook a few years ago, back when that was the thing. But Big T was, I think, you know, the fun loving kind of party guy who just used everybody else for approval. You know what I mean? I would surround myself either in person or online with people who worshipped me. You know, or who I perceived as worshiping me or making me feel good about myself, or who would say, you know, fawning things about me. And it got to a point where, you know, it breached a level of appropriateness. And it crossed over into sin and into sinful behavior. And in his mercy and in his goodness, the Lord confronted me with it and brought it to my attention and broke me for it, and in his strength I've been able to change, and I've been able to make changes that that I'm more comfortable with, you know. And that's not to say that Twitter is bad for everybody, and if you're on Twitter a lot you're sinning, but I was sinning in terms of how I used social media and how I used other people for approval, and it was gross and it was shameful, and I'm really glad, even in spite of how painful it was, I'm glad the Lord confronted me with that. And I'm glad for the better place that I'm in today because of it.
Yeah. And you mentioned being on Twitter is not a sin, right? Facebook's not a sin, and being an author is not a sin, or speaking at a big conference is not a sin. My question is, how do you do those things and not sin? So how do you be an author and not sin? How does a person be an author or speak at a giant conference and not sin?
Yeah,
and I'll say this
really
too. Sorry to interrupt you as I add to that. Like, so it comes sometimes. Like, I look at I looked at this conference of this huge amphitheater, and these guys are speaking, like these pastors, and these people are like going crazy, right? And it was frothing at the mouth, like for this, the pastor speakers, like getting them all riled up and stuff. And it feels a lot like celebrityism. And so kind of throw that into the mix there as I ask this, like, is celebrityism a sin? And, you know, those sorts of things, like, how do we manage this stuff?
Yeah. No, man, you're asking amazing questions here, and I apologize in advance to your audience for not having questions, or not having answers that are as
well. And I ask you, and let me say this, Ted, I ask you because, like, I'll point to your book, Finding God in the Dark and Household God. Like, you go places where most people aren't going to go. And I don't expect you to have, like, I don't expect you to have these million-dollar answers, but, like, you're willing to be honest and transparent, and you're willing to admit some of your own failures in these areas.
Right.
And I just think that is really helpful, you know, for all of us to just find the heart of Christ through this. So that's why I asked you. So I appreciate your transparency and those sorts of things.
Oh, dude, thank you, man. Thank you for those kind words. And I think to what you asked, and you threw a lot out there, man, so I'm going to throw you a lot back in return.
Sure.
Number one, people love money. You know, people love money. People in churches love money. People in churches love people with money, and often celebrities have money. So, you know, if you kind of follow that line of logic out, that explains a lot in terms of why we love the conference circuit, why we love the sort of arena rock feel of the conference circuit. You know, you buy the ticket, you go into the big venue, it's light, it's bright. You're ready to laugh. The guy tells a couple of crappy jokes, and you're rolling. And then you're walking to the table and back, and throwing down $40 to get all of his books. And there's an intoxicating element to that, both on the part of the speaker and on the part of the audience. You know, it's fun to be a part of the audience because, you know, that by and large, it's pastors sitting in those seats dreaming about, you know, that could be me on stage one day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you're buying not only the book, but you're buying the dream as well.
Mm-hmm.
And for the guy up on stage, it's intoxicating because, you know, I got to get on an airplane. I got to fly away from my local church and all of its problems and go and land in this city where nobody really knows me. Nobody really expects anything from me except they want to pat me on the back and tell me how much they love my last book.
Yeah,
and I mean, I can tell you again from a small degree of experience how intoxicating that is, and it really is a rock star sort of experience. So now the question becomes, how do you do that, and how do you serve people in that without becoming a whore to it? You know, without becoming the guy who needs it. And you know, I would point people to a great book by Timothy Keller called Counterfeit Gods, where. Mm-hmm. Keller talks about idolatry, and he talks about this dynamic that happens when, you know, a good thing suddenly becomes something that we can't live without.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's taken away or if it's threatened in some way, we can't worship God. You know, we can't still thank God for his goodness if he takes away, you know, my publishing career, my conference circuit, or whatever the case may be. And dude, again, that book came to me in a really good time in my life where it just served as a chilling reminder of what I don't want to become.
Sure.
I don't want to become the guy who has to have all this. And it's hard, dude, you know, I mean, just with anything that you love. And before publishing, for me, it was football. You know, it was being an athlete.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was going, God, like, can I still love you if you take football away from me?
Mm-hmm.
And can I still love you if you take publishing away from me or God forbid my spouse or my kids? And I mean, there are real people going through these crucibles every day. So it's not really hypothetical that we say that, but I think it's a reminder that we have to hold these things with a loose hand. And you go into publishing saying, I want to write a great book. I want to be the best author I can be, but I don't want to need this. You know, and I don't want to need the approval that comes with it. And if you're the kind of person who feeds on approval, then guard your heart. You know, listen for the Spirit and be willing to change is what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mentioned earlier, I kind of said for this part of the podcast, we're not going to mention any names, right? And then I said that because what I want to talk about a little bit is like, where is there any accountability in all of this for, you know, for publishers, for sure, but for these pastors,
yeah.
people like myself, right? And so, and the reason there's kind of two sides to it, and it's tough. So, like I said, listening to the Happy Rant about the bestseller stuff, I started getting online and following these trails of like, oh, so this, whatever. And I started feeling this like nauseous feeling in my stomach. Well, anyway, this nauseous feeling led me to Stephen Furtick in a video that of I know you want to say a lot of things there about nauseous feeling and Stephen Furtick going together. But he had this this sermon that he did at this conference, a big, you know, amphitheater rock style conference that we were talking about. And this was like a clip of the sermon called It Will Happen. And he was like, he had the mic like he was a hip hop, you know, artist. And he was just like, and the band was playing, and he was like, man, it will happen. It will happen. Yeah. And he's like, he's getting people up, man. He's like, everybody up. Everybody raise your hand. And this like place is full of people. And he says, tell the person next to you, it will happen. It will happen, right? Okay. First of all, like, everything I've ever read of his or heard is like that exact same message, and I hate it. I hate it because and here's why. So, and I'm going to bring you into this personally here. Your first chapter of Finding God in the Dark is how you and your wife can't have children, and I would never bring that up in an interview except that you bring it up. You talk about it publicly in your book, I really appreciate that. So you talk about the struggle of infertility, right? And so talk to us a little bit about that, and then tell me when you hear a sermon like Furtick or Joel Osteen, who's actually at the same conference, literally, Joel Osteen's preaching with Stephen Furtick here at this conference, and it will happen, right? It will happen.
Yeah.
Okay, and it made me laugh. I thought maybe the title of Finding God in the Dark should have been It Won't Happen, and then you try to sell It Won't Happen. So, I want to punch Stephen Furtick in the face when I hear that message, and I want to talk about how do we wrestle through a really bad doctrine and rebuke it the way the Bible says, you know, without punching someone in the face. But tell me first about a little bit about infertility and the struggle with that, and what it feels like for you just as a Christian when you hear a message like, it will happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first on infertility, I mean, it was a nightmare for us, man. And it was a nightmare for our marriage, and especially for my wife, because all of what she kind of dreamed about in terms of womanhood was really wrapped up in that. Right.
Yeah.
And we did, Noah, I mean, we had people at various times who weren't Stephen Furtick, thankfully, but who were people. I mean, we had people giving us similar messages, like, you know, you just have to believe and it'll happen. And, you know, God wants you to have children. And what we had to slowly accept was, for whatever reason, God doesn't want us to have biological children, and he's not allowing us to do so. And that, boy, I mean, even just saying it as a sentence like that, it trivializes the pain that was there and how long that took. And, you know, this process of going, all right, if it's not going to happen, and whether the thing is having children or getting married or writing a book, or, you know, that book, Finding God in the Dark, ended up being about a lot of things that didn't happen. You know, honestly, a lot of things that I dreamed about, that I hoped for, that just didn't happen, you know. And if those things don't happen, can I still love God, and can I still be thankful? And I think ultimately the answer was yes, because of the one thing that did ultimately happen and that I can count on, which is, you know, if I confess my sins, he's faithful and just to cleanse me of my sins and forgive me of all unrighteousness. And, and you know, that's the thing that did happen. And that's the thing that is happening and that does happen. And, you know, everything else is kind of negotiable, and everything else is sort of a thing that God in his sovereignty may or may not choose to give me for my own sanctification. And, you know, what's more, if I trust that a God who loved me enough to send his son to die for my sins and redeem me is in control of my life, you know, that book deal falling through, or even not being able to have biological kids, that's that's going to ultimately work out for my good, and it's going to ultimately work out for his glory. And these things sound like, they sound like pat answers to people who are going through the struggle right now, but I can honestly say that they're not, and that they bring a lot of comfort, man. They bring so much more comfort than some guy in some arena at some show, you know, that some person is overpaid, you know, an ungodly amount of money for, to be screaming into a little aerobics instructor mic saying, you know, it's going to happen. You know, don't give up on your dream, because, you know, look, a lot of times your dreams aren't going to happen. You know, they just aren't. And if they all did, then you would be God. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, if all of our dreams came true, we wouldn't need God. We wouldn't need Stephen Furtick or anybody else, because we would be God.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, man. Well, and so something I blog about things every once in a while, and I people about Stephen Furtick or Rob Bell or whoever it is, and there's a lot of gossip out on the internet, right? And you know, you could Google like Mark Driscoll, for example, like you said, and you're gonna find a lot of gossip out there, and I wonder, like, what's the balance between there's gossip, but then there's holding someone accountable. And it doesn't seem like there's any real accountability in the Christian, like, celebrity circuit. But in the Bible, right, so I had a couple passages here that I just thought would be helpful. Like Titus 1:9, it talks about, this is the qualifications to be an elder. It says that an elder must hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it's been taught, so that he can encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who oppose it. So if there's people that are refuting sound doctrine, like Stephen Furtick, the Bible tells me as an elder, because I am, I'm a pastor in my church and I'm an elder in my church, that I am to oppose that. And it's not to slam Furtick or whoever. It's not to rip on them or be gossipy. It's because, honestly, Christians, and this is no offense at all to anybody listening, but look at all the people in that crowd. I mean, people eat that stuff up. Like, there's a reason that Joel Osteen leads the world in, like, Twitter followers or whatever, right?
Sure.
One other verse I just find is, like, incredible for this conversation is 1 Timothy 4:2-3. It's a little bit long, so I'll just read the last section of it. But it says, these teachers, they're going to gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. So it says, to suit their own desires, people will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. And our job, in verse 2 says, is to correct and to rebuke. And so you have this message. Who doesn't want to hear a message? It will happen, right? Itching ears. Now, we're called in the Bible to rebuke that and to refute it. I don't think punching Stephen Furtick in the face is probably what Jesus would have me do, right? Like, Jesus tells me, love your enemies. He tells me in Romans, Paul says in Romans 12, if they're hungry, feed them. So how do we, you and I, others, you know, how do we hold people accountable and refute bad doctrine without sinning ourselves, right?
Yeah, great question, man. And I think, you know, there's so much in that question, because what you asked was, how do we do it? And I think ripping somebody on social media or kind of continuing to harp on somebody on your blog is probably not the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, I don't know what the right way is in this day and age. You know what I mean? Because we are so, on one level, we're more connected than we've ever been, but in a way, we're also completely disconnected in that, you know, I could make a career out of, you know, writing about Rob Bell, having never met Rob Bell. You know what I mean?
Like,
and that's a reality of this day and age. So, you know, I think you're always going to have Rob Bells and Stephen Furticks, because those guys, for whatever reason, they're really good at being popular. You know what I mean? Whether it's the way they look, how they talk, what they're saying, or more likely just a mashup of all three of those factors. They're good at being popular. You know, see, you don't want to spend your life, you know, kind of going after the Rob Bells and Stephen Furticks of the world. But on the other hand, there comes a time and a place to say, you know, I'm not with that person, you know. Because to the world at large, they may see this title or this banner Christian and assume that I am like Stephen Furtick or that I believe the same thing as Rob Bell. And, you know, I think there's a time and a place in our friendships and our families and our personal relationships to make those kind of distinctions. And there's a time and a place to make those kind of distinctions in writing. You know, I've done some of that in my own career, and you have too. So I think there's a way to do that. But again, if you're drawing all your energy and all your kind of approval, or even, you know, the small measure of personal celebrity that you have out of being the guy that's trying to take Stephen Furtick to the woodshed, then I think, you know, you got to question that. Is that the guy you want to be? And I think technology makes it really easy to be that guy.
Yeah. It's a tough age we live in, honestly, because the message is out there via technology, right? So this like crappy theology is being given via Twitter and Facebook and books. And that's how my churchgoers are consuming it that way. And so it's like, if they're consuming it that way, then doesn't there need to be sort of the prophetic voice alongside of it, how they're consuming it? It's like, no, don't. I don't know. Tough, man. I think that's some really good advice, though. I got two quick questions, man. Thanks. You've been really generous with your time, and you've been great. I really appreciate it.
Dude, I've loved it, man. It's a great chat.
Cool. Thanks. Well, tell us quick about your newest book, The Dropbox. March 1st is when it came out. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, newest book, The Dropbox, man, is really one of those – it was one of those perfect projects in which there was very little of me in it. And I think after writing Finding God in the Dark and Household Gods, I was a little bit tired of myself, and I was tired of my own voice.
Yeah, right.
You know, this Dropbox dropped in my lap literally when there's a guy named Brian Ivey, a filmmaker from the USC Film School, made a short film about a pastor in South Korea who adopts these severely special needs kids through a Dropbox in his house. And Brian read about it in the LA Times. He was moved. He wasn't a Christian, believe it or not, when he decided to make the film. And then he flew to South Korea. He made a film about this pastor. And as a result of doing that, he became a believer himself. He had his heart broken, and he was confronted with his sin and his brokenness kind of as a result of filming these broken kids who are loved unconditionally by this pastor. So that's the story that we tell in the book, The Dropbox, which is kind of a parallel story of Brian's conversion and the work that that Pastor Lee's doing in South Korea. And dude, I have to tell you, like, writing the book, which was entirely a story about somebody else, and being able to be in relationship with that someone else, it was just a gift, man. It was a gift from the Lord. It came at absolutely the right time for me and my career in terms of being a project that I could really dive into and really get behind on a story level, but that had also nothing to do with me, other than just being able to share in this guy's joy and being able to share in this beautiful story. So it was a real privilege to be able to do it. It came out March 1st. There was a big Focus on the Family did a big film release with it too. It was actually here in Lansing at Celebration Cinema for a week. And it's beautiful, man. It's a beautiful book and a beautiful movie. If you get a chance to check it out, I would highly encourage you.
That's cool, man. And I'll say this. This is something God's been showing me recently, is how we really need to celebrate the global church and global Christians and the work of God around the world. You know, these people that are persecuted and being killed for their faith in basement churches. And I tell you, man, these are people that are not doing it to become celebrities, right?
Right.
And their faith is stronger than ours. It's more pure than ours. It's more zealous than ours, and I'm grateful for any time that we can look to the global church to say, teach us, and that's awesome. That it sounds like that's what your book does. So, cool. Well, hey, my last question. This is just kind of something I like to ask everybody that I interview on Behind the Curtain. But so, and you have a unique perspective on pastors because you're not a pastor, but you know you're a Christian college professor, you're a Christian author. You rub shoulders with a lot of pastors. So how should churchgoers that are listening to this, how should they see their pastors, and how can they treat their pastors to try to just help keep their pastors, you know, healthy and human?
Yeah. Well, my My best friends in the world are pastors, man. For whatever reason, the Lord's given me great guys in my life who love me and who are also pastors for a living.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful for that. So I do think I have a unique perspective on it. But I've got a pastor. My pastor right now, Norm Dufferin, is such an amazing guy because almost every sermon, you know, he's a really good preacher and a really good teacher, and he's just a winsome, interesting guy to listen to. So there's that. But I would say at least once in every sermon, he talks about his own sin struggles. And this was such a game changer for me, man. And it was such an amazing thing because it we're learning from him and we're growing because of his teaching, but we can also connect with him on a completely human level. And it creates a culture of honesty and transparency in our church that I think is really an amazing thing. And it's a gift. It's a gift to our congregation because he sets the tone in that. So I think in that, you know, appreciating your gifts, the gifts that your pastor brings to the table is one thing that a congregation can do. But also seeing your pastor as a real person who's a sinner, who has their own sin struggles, and praying for them in that is another really tangible thing that that a congregation can do. And I think I would add a third thing, and this is totally just from my own life and my own friendships with these guys, and it's being willing to treat your pastor like a regular guy.
Yeah, you know, that's huge, man.
Some of my greatest times with these guys are when we're watching football together or laughing or watching a crappy, like, action movie from the 90s and making fun of it, which is just, like, regular guy stuff to do, you know? And those are great times for me, and I think they're great times for them where they can kind of come down off the pedestal and just be a regular guy, and hopefully, you know, that's helpful for them, and it's a way that I can serve them.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's an art to that because there's people, you know, in my church who I love and love me, and they'll say, hey, when you're around me, I just want you to know, like, you can just be yourself. Just, like, you don't have to act like a pastor, you know.
Yeah.
But whenever I'm around them, I never feel like I can be myself. There's something, there's some way that they're treating me and acting, and maybe it's just, I don't know, we're hanging out and, like, they're, like, asking me church questions. I like how I'm always the pastor around them.
Yeah.
Even when they tell me that I'm not. And so I think what you're hitting on is it's actually kind of rare to have that within your own congregation.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know if there's a way, like, any advice of how to do that specifically for your own pastor. Because I think it's easier to do, you know, the friends of yours that are pastors of other churches. But, like, for you and Norm, how do you do that?
I think just being yourself and not being weird around your pastor, you know, I mean, Norm, and dude, part of this speaks to, like, the transparency that we talk about. Like, Norm knows, he knows my sin issues, and he knows stuff about me because he's my friend, but also because he's my pastor. So, but primarily because he's my friend, to be honest. And, you know, I think because that's the case, I can enter into these times of hanging out with him without having to, like, you know, put on any kind of veneer or a show, like, ooh, I'm hanging out with a pastor, I better be a certain way. You know, I can laugh and I can make my jokes and I can just be myself when I'm around him in such a way that it kind of empowers him to do the same thing. And,
that's cool.
You know, at the same time, he's got a really sensitive conscience, and there have been times when he's called me up after we've hung out for a night and he's gone, hey, I'm really sorry for that joke I made or that thing I said.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really great though, because it's winsome and it's the gospel at work, man. And I would have a soft heart like that. You know, like that's the kind of guy I want to be around, because that's the kind of guy I want to be, you know. I want to have a soft heart myself. And, you know, he, in addition to being really fun to hang out with, he spurs me on in that area as well.
Cool, man. Well, hey, I told my dad that this episode would be shorter than the first one to his feedback. Oh, it was great, but it was a little too long. Well, Dad, I failed you, so sorry about that.
Well, I'm sorry about it, too. I was the one that gave really long answers, so tell your dad.
No, man, I could do this all day. This is great. No, this is awesome. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your writing. I really do, because I have a heart to just, get behind the curtain, you know. I mean, that's why we call it this. It's like, we're just real people, and
man, like, let's just make Jesus the hero and stop trying to be heroes and stop making people into heroes and make Jesus the hero. But that's so much easier said than done. So I think we, in this conversation, contributed to making Jesus the hero and helping, you know, the kingdom sort of see Jesus as the hero. So pray for me, you know, man, and I'll pray for you as we, you know, as you write and as I pastor and want to be a writer and not sin and doing it, man. So thank you so much, Ted. Thanks for your time. And
dude, thank you for having me on, man. It was a pleasure. And
absolutely.
Yeah, let's do it again for sure.
Cool. Sounds good, Ted. Thanks, man. Talk to you later.
All right, bro. Talk to you soon. Bye.
While Ted is not personally on Facebook, he does have an author page, Ted Cluck, on there, managed by his friend Zach Bartels. You also can check out Ted's website, tedcluck.com. You can see a list of his books there, and he also is active blogging there at his site. I also encourage you to go to my blog at acrossroads.net. And I'll have a page on there about today's episode, some sneak peeks in next week's episode, and there'll be some links on there, some bonus links, things like that for you to check out. I'm going to do a new episode of Behind the Curtain every 2 or 3 weeks or so, so I encourage you to subscribe. I won't have a regular schedule for you to check out, so just subscribe on iTunes, and they will magically appear whenever I post a new one. So please do that if you like what you hear. Quick preview for our guest next episode. We're going to be interviewing Mike Mortar. Mike was the co-founder of the band Churchill. Churchill began as a band in 2009, and you probably have heard their music before. In 2012, their hit single Change reached number 17 on Billboard's Alternative Songs chart. And their EP for Change reached number 9 on Billboard's Heat Seekers chart. Mike and his band, they toured Europe with Pink. How many of you can say you've done that, right? They played on several late shows, which we'll ask him about, several of the big, you know, network late shows. So Mike and I are going to talk about fame, like actual fame, not just Christian fame, you know, being this little Christian subculture, but actually being famous as a musician in mainstream music industry, being a celebrity, being around like really big celebrities like Pink and others, about touring, the pressure that goes along with this, but also about Jesus and really like the purpose of this podcast, you know, how our identity in Christ can really get muddled up and all that other stuff, you know, the insecurities that come with ups and downs of the music industry and what everybody thinks of you and those sorts of things. So really want to check it out. Don't miss it. It's going to be a really interesting interview. Mike's going to have some perspective that you're not going to be able to find anywhere else. So the band Churchill, they're no longer active, but I do encourage you to still check out their music on iTunes. And I'll close out this episode of the At a Crossroads.net Behind the Curtain Ministry Podcast with a sampling of Churchill's hit single, Change. You can also listen to Change in its entirety for free at acrossroads.net. See you next episode at the crossroads and behind the curtain. To make you want me, I can fabricate the truth. I'll give you easy, it'll keep me destitute. You hang me up on the line, hang me out to dry.